Thanks for downloading this show from PC One. Before we get rolling, here's a word from one of the folks who helped bring you this podcast. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar. And now, here's your host, Clay Smith.
Welcome to Fully Booked, the Kirkus Reviews podcast. I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor-in-chief of Kirkus Reviews. And my lovely co-host is Megan LaBrice, star reporter for Kirkus Reviews. Hi, Megan.
Oh, hi, Clay. Do go on.
I would go on, but I do have some news to tell our listeners, which is that we have a new hotline where you all can call and ask all of your questions about books and tell us all of your book emergencies. The hotline, so to speak, is 888-245-0618. And if you are stumped with what you should read next, let's say you loved a certain book, you can't find another book like it, call us at that number, leave a voicemail, and we will play the best questions on the podcast. So, Megan, we've got our first call. Let's listen to it.
Oh, my God.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm loving the podcast, but I was wondering, is Clay wearing pants? Because it sounds like he might not be wearing pants.
Okay. I don't know who made that phone call.
Well, you know, caller, it's not called fully clothed. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I don't see this as any false advertising on our part. And, you know, Clay, I just an hour before our recording got off the phone with cultural critic Charles Taylor. Mm-hmm. He has a book coming out on the shadow cinema of the American 70s soon. It's called Opening Wednesday at a Theater or Driving Near You.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about, you know, like that physical component, the movie going, you know, going into that theater with a bunch of strangers and the lights go down and you watch the movie. I mean, for that, to enjoy a movie out in public, you should put on pants. But to read a book, you certainly don't have to, nor do you have to do a podcast, I'd say.
I guess you don't have to do a podcast, but I do drive to the studio. So I just want to say that I am wearing pants right now. I just don't know whose pants they are.
I wonder who that caller could be.
I do not know, but she's an awful human being. So, again, the number for our podcast hotline is 888-245-0618. Call us with all your book emergencies, and we might play your question on the air. So, Megan, I'm going to talk to Chris Whipple today. He is a producer at 60 Minutes and has this great new book called The Gatekeepers, which is about how the personalities of the chiefs of staff in recent American history have done their job. You know, it's fascinating because we in the news, we talk about the Secretary of the Treasury or Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State, but we don't really talk that much about the chiefs of staff. So we're going to learn all about that.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I'm really looking forward to hearing that interview. But first, if I might, I have to make a correction.
Uh-oh.
I know, but we're journalists here and you should feel safe with us. And this is something that sometimes we must do. On the April 25th podcast, and that was our episode with Mohsin Hamid and Leslie Nekarima. Mm-hmm. While the Kirkus critics still do not recommend Fairball by Derek Jeter, it was unfair of me, okay, it was just plain inaccurate, to allege that Jeter owns a painted portrait of himself as a satyr. That's actually A-Rod, Alex Rodriguez, who owns a painted portrait of himself as a centaur. Mm. And it's over his bed. Sorry, Derek Jeter, that's my mistake. And thank you, Deborah, for the correction and for knowing about the sports. This was actually a hot topic on our interoffice messaging app.
Yeah. It was. We apologize, Derek Jeter. And so who are you going to talk to on this episode?
I'm talking to Rakesh Satyal, and I've had the privilege of speaking with him before. He is an amazing author. He has a sophomore novel out, and it's called No One Can Pronounce My Name. And I think we'll all learn a lot together. Before we have Chris Whipple on the show, Fully Booked listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. My personal recommendation this week is Priest Daddy by Patricia Lockwood, a hilarious memoir about what it's like to grow up with a Catholic priest as your father. No, really. It's an actual thing that can happen. You can download Priest Daddy or another audiobook free by trying audible.com. You could try The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins, The Hobbit Unabridged by J.R.R. Tolkien, Divergent by Veronica Roth, Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak, or many, many other titles available. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/booked. Again, that's audibletrial.com/booked. For your free audiobook.
Nice. Okay, well, let me tell you all about Chris Whipple, and we'll talk to him, and then you'll talk to Rakesh.
Great.
After a presidential candidate wins an election, some of the marquee positions in the administration are announced with great fanfare. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Treasury, for example. But the job that has the potential to wield more power than any of those is one the American public pays less attention to: the Chief of Staff. The Chief of Staff controls access to the president, executes the president's vision on policy, has a powerful say in political strategy, and directs White House staff and cabinet secretaries. And the job doesn't require confirmation from the Senate. In other words, a compelling, fascinating, candid book examining how the personalities and management styles of various chiefs of staff have done their jobs has long been needed. Chris Whipple's The Gatekeepers is that book. It's extremely well reported. He interviewed all 17 former chiefs of staff, and it's a real pleasure to read. You get the feeling reading this book that you have total access to what it's like to work in the White House with all the pressures of the country and the world raining down on you. And for political junkies, The Gatekeepers, which recently hit the New York Times bestseller list, is pure nirvana because of the author's interest in revealing the dirty little details of political life in the White House. Chris Whipple is a multiple Peabody and Emmy Award-winning producer at 60 Minutes and primetime on ABC. He is the writer and executive producer of The Spy Masters, CIA and the Crosshairs, airing on Showtime. He began the reporting in The Gatekeepers from working on a documentary about the chiefs of staff for the Discovery Channel. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can you talk a little bit about how you got interested in this topic in the first place? I mean, I know you got a phone call from the initial creators of that documentary about the chiefs of staff.
Yeah, you know, it's stunning to me that a book like this had never been done before. I mean, I still can't believe that nobody beat me to it. But it really did begin with this phone call out of nowhere from this great director, Jules Naudet, and he and his brother Gideon wanted to know if I would partner with them on a film about all the White House chiefs. And so after thinking about that for 30 seconds or so, I said, I'm in. And we did it. It aired in 2013. But in my view, it really just barely scratched the surface of this unbelievable, untold story of these 17 living White House chiefs who were not only the president's closest confidants, but really the guys who make the difference between success and disaster mm-hmm. for every presidency. And I just found it fascinating, not only the lessons that I think these chiefs have to impart, but also it's just such a fabulous cast of characters, you know, from H.R. Bob Haldeman to Rahm Emanuel and Dennis McDonough and all the rest.
Yeah, yeah. No, and personality is really at the heart of this book. You know, it's not a dense policy, wonkish kind of book. So I love that about it. So let's get... you know, the Trump administration is not covered in this book, but it's inevitable that I would have to ask you about Reince Priebus, who is the President Trump's chief of staff. And can I just say, you know, when he's on the political talk shows, he comes across as a real kind of hothead. And I'm inclined to not like him very much. But then I, you know, to give him the benefit of the doubt, I kind of think that he may have the most difficult chief of staff job of any of the former chiefs of staff, because part of his job is to discipline the White House. And President Trump has so little discipline.
Yeah, it's the most dysfunctional White House in modern history. part of that is on Priebus. Most of it is on Donald Trump, I think. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's interesting because in I wrote a hasty epilogue to this book right after the election in which I said that the only chance Trump has of governing successfully is to empower a White House chief as first among equals, which clearly has not happened. Mm-hmm. And in December of 2016, 10 ex-White House chiefs of staff went to the White House at the invitation of the outgoing chief, Dennis McDonough, to meet with Priebus and give him advice. They were consistent about one thing, which is that his only chance of succeeding would be to make sure that he was first among equals in the White House. Priebus dutifully took notes, but the chiefs of staff went away from that meeting convinced that given the president he reports to, that it would be a Herculean task. And so it has proved to be.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's take people back a little bit. You really start this book during the Nixon administration by writing about Bob Haldeman, who is really viewed as the person who created this sort of modern template for how a chief of staff should organize the White House. But he also went to jail because of what he did as the chief of staff. So what are the positive qualities that makes people admire Haldeman's work for Nixon? And what are the qualities that landed him in jail?
Yeah, so what an unbelievable irony. I mean, it fascinating character, because Haldeman was, you know, he revolutionized, first of all, he revolutionized the art of campaigning. You remember 1968 when he essentially created the modern presidential campaign by making sure that Nixon, by shooting these television commercials of Nixon and giving him enough time and space to think, and giving him rest. Anyway, he came into the White House obsessed with process, reading everything he could. Nixon wanted, as he called it, a pluperfect son of a bitch as White House chief of staff, and he learned that lesson watching Sherman Adams, who was Ike, you know, Dwight Eisenhower's famously gruff and tough gatekeeper. But Haldeman took it to another level. I mean, he really created the template, as you mentioned. All of his successors, or most of them, would point to him as a guy who really knew what he was doing. I mean, he was the ultimate gatekeeper, creating, as I said before, time and space for Nixon to think. He was the so-called honest broker who made sure that every decision was teed up with information on both sides. He was the heat shield, taking all of the incoming fire so the president wouldn't have to. But ultimately, he executed the president's agenda. His unraveling, you know, his fatal flaw was that he was unable to tell Richard Nixon what he didn't want to hear, the hard truths, when Watergate overwhelmed them. And I had a fascinating conversation with Don Rumsfeld about that and about Haldeman. And Rumsfeld said, you know, I don't think Haldeman ever told Nixon no. He was dutiful. And then he paused and he smiled and said, I was less so. That was, of course, under Gerald Ford.
Right, right. And so was it difficult to get any of these former chiefs of staff to talk with you?
You know, we had a real breakthrough early on. I had left ABC News. I'd been there for years. I was out on my own, didn't know where to start. How do you find Dick Cheney's home address, for example? We can just send him a letter. So my wife went online, and she came back a few hours later, and she said, I've got it. I said, you're kidding. You've got Cheney's home address? Where'd you get it? And she said, it was on warcriminals.com.
Oh my God. Well,
that was the research breakthrough, and we started from there. Right. Actually, Rumsfeld was the first to say, and by the way, Cheney loves that joke. He's got a wry sense of humor.
Yeah,
he can laugh at himself. Yeah. But anyway, it started with Rumsfeld, then we got Cheney, and it was a process of attrition. I think that they talked among themselves. I think they told one another that, you know, the questions are tough, but they're fair. It was just a process of about a year and a half of getting them all on board.
And so Presidents Ford and Carter, according to your book, sort of thought that they didn't need powerful chiefs of staff who they backed up. What went wrong for those two presidents?
Well, you know, Gerry Ford had this crazy idea that may sound very familiar at the moment with the current White House, that he could have five or six senior advisors coming and going, equal access to the White House, nobody empowered as the chief of staff, no real chain of command. He called it the spokes of the wheel with himself at the center. Well, that was a disaster. You know, after a month, you know, somebody described it as Ford was learning by fire hose. You know, he couldn't govern. He couldn't prioritize. It was unmanageable. And so within a month, he had reached out to Rumsfeld, who was ambassador to NATO, and an old friend and a tough taskmaster. And Rumsfeld came in and with help from his deputy, Dick Cheney, really turned the Ford White House around. I mean, Jimmy Carter came in convinced that he could run the White House by himself. Again, a little bit like the current president. Well, he discovered, as every president learns often the hard way, that he couldn't do it. And 2.5 years in, he made Hamilton Jordan his chief. He actually chose the wrong guy, but at least he appointed a chief. And finally, in the last year of his presidency, he had a first-rate chief in the person of Jack Watson, a very skilled, organized, bright attorney from Atlanta. But anyway, every president learns this lesson ultimately, and it'll be interesting to see if Trump learns it. You cannot run the White House without empowering a White House chief. It's nothing like running a family real estate firm in Manhattan. And it's clear, the lessons of history are clear on that.
But there's also this lesson in the book that these, like Don Regan, who served as chief of staff for part of Ronald Reagan's administration, you know, he had been a Wall Street CEO, and there are other former chiefs of staff who had been, quote, principals, as you call them, you know, people who were used to being in the spotlight. And you make the case that those are the worst people to do the chief of staff job, because you have to have quite a bit of, I guess, humility might be the right word.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not my argument. It's not my original argument. Everybody's heard of Rumsfeld's rules. Well, this is one of Jim Baker's rules. You know, he points out that the most important word in the title is staff, not chief.
Right.
And the moment you think that you're the boss and that you can simply snap your fingers and order people around, you're in for trouble. Don Regan was imperious, regal, pompous. He liked to have his arrival announced when he walked into a room. Ladies and gentlemen, the chief of staff to the president of the United States. He became a laughingstock among the White House staff, and ultimately he sealed his fate in a contentious phone call with Nancy Reagan, when he hung up on her. As Jim Baker said, that's not just a firing offense. That may be a hanging offense.
Right. Clearly it was. And so you mentioned James Baker.
Oh, you know, personality, temperament is really important in that job. And I think Jim Baker and Leon Panetta were, you know, almost in a class by themselves. I mean, other very good chiefs, through the last 50 years, but those two guys were grown-ups. They were comfortable in their own skin, and they could, you know, Panetta ran the White House with an iron fist and a velvet glove, as somebody put it to me.
Right. And I sort of came away from the book thinking that of all the former chiefs of staff, you might admire James Baker, who, of course, was chief of staff for Reagan and then also served for George H.W. Bush, that you might admire him the most. Is that accurate, what you say?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, as my old friend Susan Zirinsky, who was a White House producer, put it, Baker had the secret sauce. I mean, he really knew his way around Capitol Hill. He knew how the White House operated. He was comfortable in his own skin. He was a 50-year-old, smooth as silk Texas attorney who had nothing to prove and who could walk into the Oval Office and close the door and tell Ronald Reagan what he didn't want to hear. So you think about Jimmy Carter and Reagan for a minute. Carter was arguably the most intelligent president of the 20th century. He was trained as a nuclear engineer. Reagan, not so much. But Reagan understood something that that Carter never really got, and that is that an outsider president needs an insider chief of staff to get things done, to govern. It's a lesson that Donald Trump seems oblivious to so far.
Right, right. And, you know, you have some great quotes from Baker in this book, but you have really nice, candid quotes from really all the former chiefs of staff in this book. And the typical thinking about reporting goes something like this. You know, to get someone to talk to you, even if that person doesn't want to talk to you, a reporter needs to keep showing up, and eventually that tenacity will convince a source to talk to you. You said a little while ago that you spent about a year and a half sort of interviewing the chiefs of staff. There are 17 of them, and they're all busy people. Since there are so many of them, I can't imagine that you had the time to sort of become, you know, best friends with each of them. Can you talk a little bit about how you got them to talk honestly with you?
Sure. First of all, it was about a year and a half just getting them to sit down for the first time.
Oh, I see.
And that was for the documentary. And after the documentary, I went back to almost all of them, as many as I could. And I went, in a documentary with just the voices of the chiefs, you get the view from about 30,000 feet. And I wanted the view from the ground up. I wanted the staffers who had worked under them. I wanted the deputy chiefs. I wanted the secretaries of state, sometimes the national security advisors. I even talked to CIA directors about these guys because I was doing a film for Showtime on the CIA. At the end of the day, I think it really came down to some were wary and took a while. Erskine Bowles was wary at first and then was extraordinarily candid. Mm-hmm. Once he saw that I was fair in our first go round. So on the second interview, when I went down to Charlotte and spent time with him then, he was extraordinarily candid. But at the end of the day, I really think that these guys, despite their ideological differences and their partisanship, you know, from Cheney at one end of the spectrum to Panetta and Podesta at the other, these are guys who really care about government. They care about the White House and how it's run. Mm-hmm. They care about the country, as sort of sentimental as that might sound. And I think that they wanted they know that their job is so little understood, and I think they wanted to shed some light on that.
Yeah. So each chapter of this book is sort of laser focused on the personality of the chief of staff you're writing about and how he did or didn't do the job well, except for this curious chapter about George W. Bush's first term and his chief of staff, Andrew Card. And he really takes second billing in that chapter to Dick Cheney. Could you talk about the sort of odd dynamic that was going on during that first term?
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite chapters because it's just such an unbelievable story these guys, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld, coming back into the White House, you know, many, many years after they had been Gerald Ford's young White House chiefs, this time with Rumsfeld, the mentor in the lower position, and Cheney as the empowered vice president. Andy Card, I think, you know, he defines the job of being White House chief of staff as he's the guy who makes sure that the president is never hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And I think he was pretty good, according to that definition, with George W. Bush. But the fundamental problem in George W. Bush's White House is that Bush himself did not empower a White House chief the way Ronald Reagan empowered Jim Baker, or even the way Bill Clinton empowered Leon Panetta when Panetta came in. And so Cheney was extraordinarily powerful. And I think Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, who was, I also interviewed at great length about this, Powell felt that Cheney's outsized influence in the Bush White House really undercut Andy Card's role as an honest broker. And when it came to the Iraq War, that had huge consequences. You know, I think that when you listen to Card talk about the Iraq War, you just scratch your head and you wonder, wow, why didn't they have better information? My God, you know, why didn't Card say, as maybe Jim Baker would have, hold it, let's take another look at this. It's a fascinating chapter, and it includes an untold story until now of how Bush 41, the president's father, and Jim Baker, the former chief, were so concerned about the direction of the White House that Baker went privately to Colin Powell and told him essentially to fall on his sword, which Powell would not do. He would not threaten to resign.
Yeah, I mean, that revelation is really fascinating, and also that, you know, Bush 41 sort of decided not to. I mean, it comes out in your book that he maybe wasn't a big fan of the idea of attacking Iraq, but he didn't tell his son that.
He couldn't confront his son. Yeah. I mean, it's really a kind of a Shakespearean struggle. I mean, it's fascinating to me because I talked to Brent Scowcroft, who is Bush 41's, was probably his closest friend in the world. I talked to Stu Spencer, who was the legendary Republican campaign manager, who knows all these guys well. And they were amazingly candid about the fact that there was no doubt in their minds that Bush 41 was against the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I also kind of got the sense from that chapter that maybe Andrew Card was just a little bit too nice to stand up to Dick Cheney. Is that fair?
It's possible. It's possible. I think, again, that you can't necessarily blame Andy Card for the fact that Bush 43, George W. Bush, didn't want an empowered White House chief in the mold of Jim Baker. He thought he could manage the White House himself. Perhaps he thought he was a better manager than he turned out to be. He failed to understand that you need an empowered chief to really make a White House function properly. I think Josh Bolton was when he came in after Andy Card. Andy was there 5 years and 3 months, set the modern record for longevity. But I think Bolton was a bit more forceful when it came to subjects like Iraq and other issues.
Right. And so I want to ask one more question about Dick Cheney. So you quote various people in the book saying that something changed in Dick Cheney from the time that he was chief of staff for Gerald Ford, when he was sort of more genial to work with, and his later time as vice president, when, you know, he himself said that after 9/11, America would have to go to the, quote, dark side to fight terrorism. But you also quote Cheney saying that he doesn't think something changed in him. Where I just was wondering, where do you come down yourself on that
debate.
He's such a great, Cheney's such a great story, because here was this guy who, when he was Gerald Ford's 34-year-old White House chief, was the most popular guy in Washington. Everybody loved him. The press corps loved him. He had this self-effacing sense of humor. He still has that in private. Mm-hmm. And so ever since, the chiefs have been looking at each other and saying, what happened to that guy? One theory, Brent Scowcroft's theory, was, and they were best friends until they had a falling out over Iraq. Mm-hmm. Scowcroft's theory was that his heart condition changed his whole outlook. Mm-hmm. Somebody else thought that he'd gone to the so-called dark side as the CEO of Halliburton. Cheney says he didn't change. His good friend David Kennerly thinks he hasn't really changed. My feeling is that when Cheney became vice president with nothing left to prove, and it was the last stop of his political career, he wasn't running for anything. He was in a position just to tell people exactly what he thought. Mm-hmm. He was always somewhere to the right of Genghis Khan politically, as somebody put it.
Right.
And now we could tell people, without any filter.
Right. Yeah, it was jarring. I mean, just as a citizen of the country, every time that you saw Cheney on TV, you just sort of felt like, I'd at least felt sort of depressed and dyspeptic, you just knew something terrible was going to come out of his mouth.
He still has that great wry sense of humor, certainly in private. I visited with him shortly after Obama had declared that Cheney was the worst president of Obama's lifetime.
Right.
And Cheney thought that was hilarious. He loved it.
Yeah. And so you mentioned David Kennerly, and just to tell our listeners, David Hume Kennerly was, he's known for other things, of course, but he was a photographer, or I guess the main photographer during the Ford administration. And he was
the chief White House photographer. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he ended up, becoming sort of an advisor to President Ford. Could you talk a little bit about their relationship?
Yeah. Kennerly's quite a character, and he was like a son to Gerald Ford. He was, Kennerly never minced words. He had no filter. He always told Ford exactly what he thought. He was sent, believe it or not, on a mission to Vietnam before Saigon fell, and he came back and he said, anybody who tells you that Vietnam's going to last more than 2 weeks is giving you bullshit. He was that kind of guy. And so he was one of Ford's real confidants, and could be influential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an amazing story. Okay, so last question. After reading your book, this chief of staff job, it really does sound like the worst job in history. Why would anyone actually take it on?
Every new chief, if he knows what he's doing, and so far, of course, they've all been men. But every new chief makes his first phone call to Jim Baker. And the first thing Baker tells them is, congratulations, you've got the worst blanking job in Washington. And it may be true, but it's also, as Baker would tell you, arguably the second most powerful job in government. Cheney, who ought to know, would tell you that the White House chief of staff has more power, if you want to put it in those terms, than the vice president. What he doesn't tell you, of course, is that was true except Cheney was vice president. But it's a job that, as Rahm Emanuel put it to me, are you getting wind shear? Are you getting whipped left and right? Can't tell up from down. Yes, but he said, I guarantee every chief you ask, if you ask him if they would do it again, the answer would be yes. It's a privilege to be sitting next to the most powerful person in the world, to be that person's principal confidant, the person in charge of executing his agenda. It's heady stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was, I loved reading this book. Thank you for writing it, and thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Good luck with it.
Thanks.
So, Megan, you learned all about the chiefs of staff, right?
Yeah, but he struck a new terror into my heart. I mean, I'm 34 years old, and if Dick Cheney was so beloved as a 34-year-old staff member for Gerry Ford that he could have evolved into, my hypothesis is like toxic sludge or something, you know, like, I don't know about the heart condition or even being CEO of Halliburton. I'm scared. I thought my personality was set.
Yeah. I guess you learned you have a lot of years ahead of you to go to the dark side, right?
Oh my God. Speaking of personality and temperament though, do you think that you could do that job, Clay?
Oh my gosh. I think for about a week, I could probably do that job. The shortest tenure of a chief of staff ever.
Oh my gosh.
So before we talk to Rakesh Satyal, for the listeners of Fully Booked, BarkBox is offering an opportunity to receive one free extra month of BarkBox at BarkBox.com. Every month, BarkBox paw picks the best all-natural treats and innovative toys to match a dog's unique needs, including allergies and heavy chewer preferences. All edibles are made in the USA or Canada, and 100% of our products are tested on our own animals. BarkBox is a great way to try a variety of treats and toys from local and small businesses that you might not otherwise be able to find. Each monthly box is themed, for example, Country Fair, Bark Ball, Pooh York City, and Brooklyn Hipster. New and unique toys continue to keep dogs engaged, interested, and happy. If your dog doesn't like something in the box, we'll send you something they'll love for free. Free shipping on any BarkBox within the continental United States. To receive 1 month free, go to getbarkbox.com/booked. Again, that's getbarkbox.com/booked to receive an extra month of BarkBox for free.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked. This week on All of the Above with Norman Lear, Veep star Julia Louis-Dreyfus sits down with Norman and Paul.
Well, you know, there wasn't a script when I was first talking to HBO about it. There was a concept, and my agent had said to me, listen, they're developing this thing at HBO about an unhappy vice president, an unhappy female vice president. And I thought to myself, well, I got to get in on this action because it's gold, and it's so amazing that nobody's done it before.
Listen today on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or on PodcastOne.com. This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So switching gears, totally. Tell us about Rakesh Satyal.
Okay. Rakesh Satyal is an acclaimed novelist and editor, a senior editor at Atria Books, a division of Simon & Schuster, to be precise. He is the author of Blue Boy, 2010 winner of the Lambda Literary Award for Gay Debut Fiction, and his sophomore novel, which we're going to speak with him about, is called No One Can Pronounce My Name. It's the story of an unlikely friendship between two American immigrants hailing from India who live in a community outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Harut is in his mid-40s, awkward, unmarried, still living at home, and grieving the loss of his beloved sister, Swati. By day, he's a stock clerk at Harriman's department store. After work, he comes home and dresses in his late sister's sari and pretends to be her for the benefit of their ailing mother. Ranjana, also mid-40s, has always put her duties as a wife and mother first. In her private time, she has a passion for writing Indian paranormal romance. However, her only son's departure for Princeton, coupled with a scandalous discovery in her husband's browser history, sets her on a path towards self-actualization. These two characters will meet and forge a friendship that alters the paths that their lives will take. Welcome, Rakesh, to Fully Booked.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Now, before we get down to business, I recently saw on social media that at an event to celebrate the launch of No One Can Pronounce My Name, You accidentally wore the same sweater you have on in your book jacket author photo?
It was terrifying. It was like one of those things like out of a fairy tale where a monster comes out of the pages of a book or something. I didn't even realize it at the time, but maybe that becomes my branded look from this time. It decides what I have to wear for the rest of my events. I'll just wear that sweater all the time, like I'm a Simpson.
Are you wearing that sweater right now?
I'm not. I'm just wearing I own about 500 cardigans. I just rotate them out.
So based on what you've said, I would assume, like, if there is a formal ruling on this for authors, that it's maybe a fashion don't at your events, or?
I would keep a bit of air of mystery about what you wear so that people don't know exactly what to expect. But it also might give the impression that maybe I have nowhere to live. Like, I show up at bookstores and then I hang out in them and then I just move to the next one. So... which might be a point of differentiation in terms of publicity, but.
And just one more question on this fascinating topic. Did anyone try to take your picture with your picture?
Oh, yes. Oh, that definitely. I headed it off at the pass by making the commentary before anybody else could note that I was wearing the same outfit. So, of course, then it led to a photo op.
I'm sad I missed it. So now to take a completely different tack. We had a chance to speak to one another about your novel earlier for a print. Mm-hmm. And one of the parts of our conversation that really stuck with me was this phrase, which I believe we both find to be unsatisfying. Mm-hmm. And it's ethnic literature.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what has ethnic literature come to connote in our industry?
That's a very good question. And my gosh, if you had hours on end, I could keep talking about it. It's two separate things, I guess, because we have to kind of compartmentalize in a way, which is probably where the trouble begins anyway. But it's that people in the industry think of ethnic literature as what's come before. You know, they start, and that's true of any book really in publishing, is that you start to define it by what was successful before. And I stress the word successful because if you make a comparison to something, to a book that was not financially successful, people have a tendency to completely negate that comparison because it didn't sell. Mm. But oftentimes when people deem it that, they're trying to, like I said, compartmentalize it into a certain category where there's been success because they want to repeat that success and because they're comfortable in the definitions they've come to attribute to that category or that genre. So yeah. There's that definition of it. And then there's the idea of why we put quotation marks around it, which is that, sure, we have these established successes, but our job, in a way, is to find the next books that are going to move the conversation forward and not just deliver upon the same thing that we've seen before. So I think that's where we look at how that term can be both constructive and destructive.
Sure.
And so that's why I make it a point in my work to take what I think are these established understandings about a category or a genre or a group of people and try to subvert them in a way that moves the conversation somewhere else.
Absolutely. And in this case, it's something that, you know, we might come to think of as a grief narrative that mm-hmm. you have subverted. You have characters who are suffering inarguably in numerous ways. And there's still a lot of joy and excitement and laughs in this novel.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a question, you know, over the course of the book, what I hope I sort of convey is that when people process their grief, it's not just a completely inexorable grieving process. It doesn't just continue and persist and not change and worsen. And there are usually moments of levity that are thrown in. That's life, you know. And if anything, when those moments of levity appear, what they produce is a consideration on the part of the grieving person to decide whether or not that person will find the levity in that or acknowledge it, or be guilty of it or feel ashamed of it because it doesn't fall into the narrative that other people have constructed, which is that you're grieving and you can't come out of it. So I think I intentionally play with those topics, the idea of being in a grieving process, but then living your life and not falling prey to your grief. And in fact, being able to identify moments in your life that would actually pull you out of it and be constructive.
Another key subversion is we have a man and a woman who are around the same age, same ethnicity, same cultural mm-hmm. community. They find each other and they do not fall in love. Mm-hmm. It is not a marriage plot. Instead, it's a lot more ambiguous, their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of plays with the conceit that there are certain steps you're supposed to take in a relationship with a man and a woman.
That's definitely true. And in fact, the Hudit character, who's one of the two main characters that you mentioned, it was really important for me to depict a queer experience that didn't fall directly into the established gender binary, the idea of how somebody would identify as a certain gender, and not conflating issues of gender and sexuality, or if I was going to conflate them intentionally, it was so that I could highlight how they shouldn't be conflated. So that's something I play with. There's a scene in particular where their friendship is forming, and they share this moment in the kitchen when they're both making tea. And it's a moment that is, I intended to sort of toe that line as to what is happening between the two of them, but then it falls very squarely in the category of friendship. And that was the idea, is as you're noting, I didn't want it to fall immediately into what people would expect about a quote unquote relationship between a man and a woman. That in fact it would take it somewhere else and feel progressive because it was going somewhere different from what you might expect.
Now, the character of Hurut is based on a real person. Who is that?
So when I was in high school, I feel like maybe when I was in sophomore or junior year of high school, we had a family friend who had an uncle that came to town. I think he was visiting from New Jersey. And an uncle, as is often the case in Indian culture, can denote anything from an actual uncle to just a family friend or a kind of far-reaching acquaintance. So I don't know to what extent he was actually related to my family friend. But he was in his mid-40s, and he was unmarried. He lived with his mother. He looked very much the way I described the character in the book. That was something that really stuck with me. And so I didn't really know him personally, but I was disturbed in a way to hear other people basically grafting onto him a life experience that he may or may not have had, which is that they all assumed that he must have been gay because that was the lifestyle that he was leading. Mm-hmm. And it had always fascinated me, this idea that his life could have been more liberated than that. It could have been even more oppressive than that. And we didn't know how he would have defined it for himself. So that's really the genesis of this book, was that character and thinking about, how you perceive yourself versus how other people perceive you, and that there may be very fundamental parts of yourself that you haven't even thought to process or think about. And when you start that process, it really takes you somewhere in your life that you may not have predicted.
What's really lovely is at the same time, Ranjana is on this journey in her own life as well, and realizing some things about herself that maybe she hadn't paid attention to.
Yeah, I definitely, it was important to me to establish that they're both going through a process of change. They're going through their own experiences before they meet each other, that we're identifying some of the, for lack of a better term, pain points they have about themselves that they are processing. And so when they do meet each other, there is this counterpoint and interplay between the two of them to solve their problems by way of their connection, by way of things that they see in each other and the ways in which they help each other. And that's really, that's the crux of the book, is the idea that friendship is can be a solace and can be a saving grace. That those are and that friendship doesn't necessarily have to be something you make only when you're young, or it isn't just something you've experienced for several years and those are the established relationships you have with people, but in fact that it's possible to befriend people later in life. And for that to have sometimes even more meaning because you have gotten to a point in your life where you've thought more keenly about the things that matter to you and the things that define you.
Now, we all know around here that it takes a long, long time to write a novel. Mm-hmm. How long did it take to write this one?
I started it, if you're really talking about the kind of fingers going to a keyboard, in late 2010, but I am admittedly very lazy, and so I'm off for about 5 years. But if I'm really looking at concentrated work during that period of time, probably closer to three. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of a cop out, because the truth is it took as long as it took, and all of that is useful, and all of that becomes part of the process. So it isn't just those 3 years. In fact, it's probably even longer than five. But but it is sitting down and doing the work is a really, really necessary part of the process. Obviously, it's that you, I was very, very lucky to have, as my college thesis advisor and early publishing mentor, the extraordinary David Ebershoff, who had a very, very robust and successful publishing career and has had a remarkable writing career. And he said that to me. It was probably the best piece of advice I've ever gotten, which is that you're either doing the work or you're not, which is that we can all theorize about what we want to be going into the book, and we can kind of sit and wait for the muse to arrive to us, and we can, you know, make notes, and we can research, but you know, you either sit down and you do the writing and you do the work or you don't. And yeah. So I would say that the 3-year part of that is the time where I really got it into myself to sit down and do that work and put it down.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, how long ago it started, and how there's really little control on when the book will finally come out. So yeah. No One Can Pronounce My Name happens to be published at a time when racism and immigration issues are at the forefront of our media and our minds. What do you think about that synchronicity?
Obviously, it's something I thought a great deal about in the past, not just several weeks, but several months, knowing the book was coming and seeing what was happening in not just our country, but in the world. You know, it's bittersweet because if anything, I stand by the themes of the book even more now, which is that there is, again, there's solace to be found in friendship. There's solace to be found in community, in finding people who maybe, you know, not necessarily the core part of the community, but who share your worldview and who share, even if it's not the same worldview, who share the same goals or want to, you know, grow as people and grow in terms of the way they think. And so, yeah, it definitely feels bittersweet. And as you know, as I go to do events now, I mean, I've just started doing events here in basically in the New York area, but then as I go across the country, you know, it feels a bit scary in some respects to go to parts of the country where people may be less friendly about these discussions, but at the same time, it makes it feel more vital. So, you know, that's the great privilege and fear of being a writer sometimes, is that you might hit upon something that really resonates, and it may be difficult to talk about, but that's why we do it. You know, that's why you try to make work that is saying something important.
Well, you've started a lot of conversations with this book, and those who would like to continue the conversation with you should just look for the man in the red sweater at
upcoming events. It's the Grim Reaper, but yeah.
Rakesh Satyal, thank you so much for taking your time to be with us on Fully Booked today.
Thank you very, very much.
So that was great. So we learned not to wear the same thing you wore in your author photo at your launch party, which is helpful and useful. But more crucially, to not fall prey to our own grief, that there's humor during grief too, right?
Absolutely. And also not to allow oneself necessarily to be boxed in by the conventions imposed by literary society. I mean... Mm-hmm. This is a book that some people might call ethnic literature because it features Indian and Indian American characters primarily, right. But it is as smart, fun, funny, big-hearted, and provocative as any other novel. So,
yeah, read outside of what you're used to. So I told you we have this new podcast hotline, and we've got another phone call, so let's play it now.
Hi, guys. I recently read The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood because my friends were getting really excited to watch the new miniseries together, and I was the only one who hadn't read it. And I don't know if you're watching the miniseries, but it is super creepy, way creepier than the book. Anyway, I thought the book was really smart and provocative. It got me thinking about feminism and authoritarianism and a lot of other things. And I was wondering if you had any book recs along those lines. Because these are things I want to keep thinking about, especially with all that's going on. Anyways, thanks. Love the podcast.
Thank you. And so we've got on the podcast now, we have Vicky Smith, our children's and teen editor, Laurie Muchnick, our fiction editor, and Eric Liebetrau, our nonfiction editor, and of course, our co-host, Megan LaBrice. So guys, what do you think? What should she read next?
No, I indeed am watching the Hulu show. And I agree that it is super creepy. Anybody else watching?
No, not yet. But I'm dying to.
So, well, you're in for a creepy treat, Laurie.
So what do you think about our caller's question?
I think there are so many books out there that you know, have a similar gestalt to Handmaid's Tale from all different angles. I think if you're interested in the sort of dystopian, authoritarian angle, it would be interesting to read either Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro or The Children of Men by P.D. James, both of which kind of pick up on the infertility angle of The Handmaid's Tale, how a big part of the authoritarian regime in Atwood's book came about because people weren't really able to have children. So the women who were still fertile were forced into this role of being handmaids. In P.D. James's book, The Children of Men, the sperm count in Britain has dropped to zero and no one has been born in about 26 years, I think. And, you know, the book goes on to show how this affects society. The Ishiguro book is an amazing book that starts out just seeming like a kind of English schoolhouse tale. You know, you're meeting these characters who seem to live in a kind of boarding school and you don't really know what's going on. And I'm not going to tell you what's going on because it's very creepy, but it definitely fits in with this genre. Another way to go that I thought might be interesting was to go for a utopia instead of a dystopia. Like, for instance, Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time, which was written in 1976. There are so many feminist novels written in the mid-70s that you could also kind of take a look at, like The Women's Room by Marilyn French or Alex Kate Schulman's Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen. That might be an interesting way to go. Just to see a lot. There were all these feminist novels written in the mid-70s that are, they're not all that literary. They were really, the authors, I think, were really aiming to get a lot of readers and put a point across. So they're a little bit didactic, but they've got lots of plot and they're really kind of fun to read, I find. So that might be another interesting way to go.
For a recent feminist novel that's super literary, I would dust off like probably my most recommended book at this point, which is The Blazing World by Siri Hostvedt. Mm. And it's about a female artist who plays with the conventions of gender and kind of rages against, you know, the box that's encasing her as a female among many, many male artists. I also think that another possibility could be this new anthology that's out, edited by Robin Rahm, this double bind, Women on Ambition. That could be kind of something that could get the juices flowing, you know, as far as thinking about, you know, the complicated relationship that a lot of women have to, you know, ambition, success, having it all, and the difference between goals and ambition. So that could be one.
Yeah, I'll second that. The Robin Rahm, I believe we gave that a star. It offers a pretty wide variety of viewpoints, all kind of focused on that topic. But another one, I'll say it's a little, I guess, outside of the box, but if you want to talk about authoritarianism and how people tend to fall into it and follow in that way, there's a book called The Road to Jonestown that just came out by Jeff Gwynne. And it's about Jim Jones and the People's Temple and how he got kind of took over this power from nothing and basically made this what he thought was going to be utopia, which turned out to be, of course, a huge dystopia when there was the mass suicide.
All right. So, caller, you have just realized what the secret superpower is for Kirkus editors. We love to recommend books. So you've got a lot of potential books for your nightstand. And so every week we ask our editors to talk about the bestsellers in their world and whether we should be reading them or whether we should skip them. So Vicky is our children's and teen editor. Vicky, what's hot and really readable in children's books this week?
Well, coming out this week is The Shadow Cipher by Laura Ruby. She won the 2016 Prince Award for her novel for teenagers, Bone Gap. And this is her first book for middle graders. And lots of times when authors move up or down in age range, it doesn't always go smoothly, but she really nails it with this book. It's opening a trilogy called York that takes place in an alternative steampunky New York City that imagines these two visionary twins who came to the city in 1798 and had this fabulous architectural steampunky vision that includes elevators that go sideways, which is, you know, how cool is that? But it actually takes place in the present when a real estate mogul decides to buy one of the last few Morningstar, the twins were named Morningstar, the last few Morningstar buildings, and three spunky kids, Tess and Theo, who are Jewish twins, and Jaime, who is a Trinidadian Cuban boy, and they realize that there's this puzzle that's been pretty much dismissed. People don't think it's real, but they think that these twins way back in the 19th century left a puzzle, and if they can solve it, they can save their building. So it's got, you know, adventure and mystery. Our reviewer said it blended very modern elements, a solar-powered city with a really diverse cast of characters, and some very old-fashioned feeling literary elements. She compared this to E.L. Konigsberg. So it's a terrific trilogy opener.
Nice. And so if you had to pick a bestseller to skip, which you do because I asked you to, what would it be?
Also out this week is The Flame in the Mist by Renee Ahdia. And her first two novels were a duology, The Wrath and the Dawn and The Rose and the Dagger. And they were these really compelling, romantic retellings of the Arabian Nights story. And with this new story, she moves to medieval Japan with these sort of ninja-like characters and an underdog woman, but it really just doesn't come together. It's got a lot of the elements that made the Wrath and the Dawn and the Rose and the Dagger so compelling. Lots of research and action and, you know, questioning of governmental power and authority, but it just doesn't come together in a way that's satisfying. It was a real disappointment to our reviewer.
Womp womp. Sorry about that.
Well, yeah. On a lighter note, oh, something else?
Well, no, it's just a bummer. A lot of people were really excited about this book, so I'm hoping that she's able to hit her stride again with the next book.
Well, so are we.
Okay, give us some good news, Eric. What are the critics loving in nonfiction this week?
Well, the good news is that Elizabeth Warren's new book is number one on the charts.
Yay!
Yes, it's called This Fight is Our Fight, The Battle to Save America's Middle Class. And both, you know, the great news for me personally, and I think for a lot of people, is that that book, as well as the book called Shattered, about Hillary Clinton's campaign, are number one and number two. So they've helped us serve to push Bill O'Reilly's books way down and in some cases off the charts.
Ah,
which is always a good thing. And her new book is kind of a mix of memoir and current affairs. There's some brief personal history about her mother, who had to go to work at a minimum wage job when her father had a heart attack. But mostly it's, you know, in her standard style, it's very forceful, urgent, knowledgeable, unrelenting. We gave it a star, and our reviewer called it Inspiring Words to Empower Warren's Marching Army, which I'm hoping grows and grows. She's, I think, a very inspirational figure. She talks a lot about what families across America are struggling with, stagnant wages, crippling debt, both middle class and low income. But I think most importantly, it's her personal story. And her personal story in Congress, fighting a lot of these do-nothing Republicans who only want to stop bills, not actually govern. I think it's a really inspiring, very readable book, even for those who usually shy away from politically themed books. There's actually some good humor throughout, and the reviewer says that the author sounds the alarm that an oligarchy is in the making, and her urgency is palpable and necessary. So I would highly recommend this book.
I haven't read it yet. I can't wait to. I am a fan of some of her previous books, including The Two Income Trap. And
yes,
I think that part of her genius, I mean, you have here like a Harvard professor, undeniably intelligent. Yeah, but she is so relatable, and she can communicate all of these big ideas in a way that never makes you feel talked down to, but You're helps right. you understand. She's brilliant.
That's her greatest asset for sure.
Great. Okay. Well,
keep it on the list.
Yeah. So, on the other side, what did the critics not prefer this week in nonfiction?
Actually, I'm happy to report that there weren't actually many candidates for this segment this week. But I know I have to pick one. So I'm going to go with a biography of Jimmy Buffett by Ryan White, who's a sports and culture reporter, or used to be, for the Oregonian. The book is called Jimmy Buffett. You know, he has millions of fans around the world. And the author provides some decent details about Buffett's early life and career. But our reviewer said that ultimately it's a feel-good biography for parrot heads. Others may want to take a pass. So it's shot through with all laid-back kind of island vibe aura that he's famous for, but it lacks enough focus in figuring out how he came, you know, how he transformed himself from this kind of barroom favorite to an international superstar and business mogul. And that, to me, that's a fascinating transformation, whether you're a fan of his or not. But of course, there are plenty of parrot heads out there. It'll probably do pretty well. But our reviewer said you can skip.
For me, I am truly disappointed in the title. I would expect something.
It's kind of weak. I know.
A little more alcoholic. Yeah. You know, like a little more.
It's a bit of a cop out.
Yeah, like Biagra Ritaville. I don't know. I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but like, you know.
And so, thanks, Eric. Laurie, what's going on in fiction this week? What best selling book should we read?
Well, I realized, thinking back on the books I've been recommending and unrecommending the last few weeks, that usually the non-recommends have been sort of series crime books where the author gets, you know, 10 or 15 books into the series and maybe is coasting a little bit. And so the books are skippable. Mm-hmm. This week, for the first time, we have a crime book that I'm going to give the thumbs up to. So I was happy about that. And it's, I think, the first book in a series. It's called Proving Ground by Peter Blauner. If Blauner's name sounds familiar to you, it's because his first book, Slow Motion Riot, won the Edgar Award for Best First Novel way back in 1991. But if he doesn't sound familiar to you, it's because he hasn't actually written a novel in 10 years. After writing a few, he kind of took a break, and he's been writing for TV. He worked on a bunch of different Law and Order shows, mostly SVU, I think. And now he's an executive producer for the show Blue Bloods on CBS. But now he's got his first novel in quite a while. And it takes place in Brooklyn, and it's based around a victim whose name is David Dresden, who's a liberal lawyer who's found dead in Prospect Park. And he has been suing the FBI on behalf of a Muslim American mailman who was imprisoned and tortured on, you know, under false pretenses. So he's suing the FBI. He's also known as the lawyer that every cop in New York hates because, you know, he's often suing the police department for, you know, bad conduct and stuff like that. So when he's killed, his son, who's an Iraq war veteran, comes into conflict with the police who are investigating his father's murder. And the son, just before the book starts, or just at the beginning of the book, he has actually been thrown into jail himself because he has PTSD that he doesn't really want to admit he has. And in a kind of blackout, he got into a fight with a guy who turned out to be a fireman. So all the cops and the firemen don't like him because he beat up one of their own. So there's a lot of conflict going on and a lot of, you know, very up-to-date political issues and father-son issues. And one of the police officers, Lord S. Robles, who's going to be the continuing character, she's just a great Latina police detective who's, you know, got her own various troubles and is trying to make her way in the department, and she's going to go on into other books. And the other thing that's great about this book is Blauner's voice. He really just gets he just plunges you in to the jargon of the police, the lawyers. There's the opening scene actually takes place in Iraq when the dead lawyer's son is over there, and he just tosses you in, and you quickly pick up the voices of the characters, and there's no sort of explaining. It's just you're there, and it's just done really, really well and entertainingly.
Nice. And if we had to skip something, what would it be?
Well, you know what? Like Eric, it was kind of a good week. There wasn't all that much stuff to skip. But if I was really pressed, I would say one thing you could skip is The Stars Are Fire by Anita Shreve, who is a writer who focuses a lot on women in states of psychological distress. There's usually a lot of intensity in her books. Women are at a crisis point in their lives. This book takes place in 1947 near the coast of Maine, and it's a very hot, hot summer. And there's a fire, and this woman grabs her children and waits out the fire in the ocean and loses everything they have. Her husband is missing. They hadn't been getting along very well anyway. And then in the aftermath of the fire, you see her have an affair and, you know, reevaluate her life. Our reviewer said that all the contentedness at this point stalls the novel until Shreve shakes things up in a way that descends into woman in jeopardy territory. So, you know, just kind of standard, nothing, not really revelatory, not a terrible book, but you don't need to rush out and read it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys. So that's this week's podcast. Don't forget to call us at 888-245-0618. And we hope you join us next week on May 23rd for the new episode. You know what to do. Turn off this podcast and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey, I'm Emmanuel Acho, host of Beyond the Film Room, where we take the muzzle off the mouths of premier athletes. Every Thursday, join me and your favorite sports figures as we tackle the uncharted topic of sport and discuss the far-reaching impact outside of the stadium itself. Download episodes every Thursday at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe at iTunes.